13. Hessler awoke in a land of wonder. Hessler had never believed in the concept of lands of wonder. The elf lands were sometimes described as such, but they were simply very leafy and much more reliant upon nature magic than the Republic. The homes of powerful fairy creatures were said to carry that distinction, but given how fairy creatures often disrupted the minds of humans, it was more likely that visitors simply had the feeling instilled in them magically, regardless of whether the area actually merited such an emotional response. Staring across the vast golden expanse, drenched in purple and blue clouds, and with streaks of glittering green stars across the horizon, Hessler gazed with a wonder that was fully earned. After a moment, it struck him to wonder what he was lying on, and he looked down to see absolutely nothing beneath him. This resulted in a moment of flailing panic and spinning in space, before he decided that wherever he was, the rules of gravity did not seem to apply, so he was not actually falling. "Obviously a magical realm of some sort," Hessler muttered, "and simple deductive reasoning should determine which and how to get back." He spun himself around again, on purpose this time, and took in variations in the colour of the vast realm that could have been distant rolling hills. The realm of the demons was a possibility, but Hessler's studies had led him to believe that world was chaotic and filled with blazing formless energy. Being in the demon realm without protective wards was thought to be instantly fatal. "Not demons, then?" Hessler squinted at the hills, which were lighter in colour, more of a pink that shimmered like oil on water, sending tiny scintillating rainbows across its surface. "Nobody was entirely sure that the ancients even had a realm until this whole mess started, so it's possible, but..." The rainbows reminded him of something. At first he considered the fairy creatures, but Ululenia's horn had always shone brilliantly, and this was softer. It lit the cliff, but also occluded it somehow, in a way that Hessler hadn't seen since. "That's an extremely good human," came a voice from behind him. Hessler turned. A man hung in the empty golden air. His features were fine and angular, and hard to make out beyond that, as they were also lit by the same shimmering radiance that had covered the hills, leaving his skin a shadow by comparison. He was naked and had the right number of arms and legs, but they bent and wiggled bonelessly, and the arms ended in vague fingerless lumps. "This is the realm of the glimmering folk," Hessler said. "Oh, you're an actual human," said the man. And Hessler saw a little flicker of light trail back from a cord attached to the man, a cord that stretched all the way to the radiance of the rolling hills. "How delightful. I haven't tried one in ages." "Oh dear," Hessler said. And the rolling hills uncoiled into a multitude of tentacles and came toward him. Ululenia reached past the demon, slowly taking Jell's shape, grabbed the book in the hidden alcove behind the painting, tossed it to Locke, and over the blaring alarms shouted, "Indomitable! Little one! Go!" Locke caught the book, turned, and ran from the room. "Will Ululenia be safe?" Icy called behind her. "Jell wants me. I'm the one who fed her to the demon." Locke turned a corner, nearly ran into a servant, saw that it was a young woman in a hand-me-down cleaning outfit, and turned the punch she'd half-started into a shoulder brush that got the girl out of the way harmlessly. They sprinted down the hallway. It ended in a dining hall featuring a massive stained oak table, an impressive chandelier of glowing crystal, and a large number of guards. The alarm was still squealing, and the guards already had blades drawn. They turned as Locke and Icy came into the room. "Fair warning," Locke called. "There's going to be a big angry demon in here in short order. You may want to focus on that." The guards ran forward, yelling, and Locke tossed the book to Icy. "Worth a shot." She caught a raised blade with the hook of her walking stick, slammed the guard into the table, and went to work. "What on earth do you mean?" the illusion of Hessler asked Kale, and Kale flipped his dagger through the air. It flew through the illusion of Hessler's head and bounced off the wall of the alley behind him. "Like Hessler would slide down a rope without hurting himself somehow," Kale said. "Or pass up the chance to say something awkward around my mother. Derry, go low." Derry grabbed at Hessler's ankles and caught onto something. With a flash of light and a sudden burning smell, Hessler disappeared. In his place was a scorpion creature, the bulbous nodes on its back glowing and pulsing as it writhed in Derry's grip. Kale grabbed the stinger and slammed it against the wall before it caught Derry's shoulder. "You got any more tricks? Now's your chance, you spiky little asshole, because I would love for you to try something. Where's Hessler?"
"Wizard," the scorpion said.
Its voice sounded like it was being piped through a tube, and Kale realized it was coming from the thing's tail.
"Illusionist. Shadows."
It was hard to tell, but it sounded like the thing was satisfied with itself.
"Shadowlands. Glimmering folk home. Appropriate."
"You sent Hessler to the land of the glimmering folk." Derry's grip tightened. "Bring him back." The scorpion made a noise that might have been a grunt or a sigh.
"Torture. Yes. Expected. Thieves. Enemies of ancients."
Kale glared at what he thought might be the thing's eyes, still holding tight to the stinger. "Thieves, yes. Enemies of the ancients, yes. And you serve them, even though you were made by the glimmering folk."
"Glimmering folk, evil,"
said the scorpion.
"Service, redemption."
"You know, Mr. Scorpion," said Derry. "It's not a mister, kid. Kedisar's sake, I'm a mister." "I was made by the ancients, I think," Derry went on, undeterred. "I don't know whether they made me completely or just put the prophecy on me when I was a baby, but I fought the champion of dusk for them. And when I was done, I wanted to prove that I was more than just a prophecy. I joined the Knights of Gedisar to fight monsters and help people. But it didn't work. They did bad things. They hurt innocent people. Evil or good isn't who you came from or who you work for, Mr. Scorpion. It's what you do. That's all it ever is." "So, no," Kale said grimly. "No torture. The very first thing my boss, the lady you're hunting, taught me in the scouts was, fight the enemy, not their people. That means no innocence and no torture. I care about my friend, and I want him back, but I'd rather leave here empty-handed than bloody-handed." The scorpion shuddered in Kale and Derry's grasp.
"Lies!"
"Keep telling yourself that," Kale muttered. "See how it works next time your boss sends you after somebody's mother. Let them loose, Derry." He shoved the scorpion stinger away hard as Derry backed away. "The kid and I are leaving. You come after us again, I will kill you with a clean conscience and sleep just fine that night." The scorpion scuttled backward, chittering wordlessly. Shadows closed around it as it left the alley, and then it was gone. "Could it have gotten Mr. Hessler back?" Derry asked quietly. "It never helps to ask yourself that, kid." As soon as Locke and Icy had cleared the doorway, Ululenia turned to the demon. It was already pulling itself into a humanoid shape. Its legs had taken on the texture of the carpet, its body was the same stone as the wall, and its arms were the wood of the bookshelves. "You will not have her," Ululenia said, and her horn blazed with the strength of her words.
"Locke is mine," the demon roared, and strode toward Ululenia. "No unicorn can stop me."
Then it paused in surprise as vines coiled around its legs. "I feel pity," Ululenia said, "as the wolf who sees the dog with its leg in a trap." The vines twisted and coiled, and the demon slammed into the wall. Jell hated Locke, and when the wind demon devoured her, that hatred was still fresh enough for you to catch it, Ululenia went on, as a demon ripped free from the vines, only to catch itself in the tangle of branches that had sprouted from the bookshelf. The seed of that hatred blossomed inside you, and you were perverted into this.
I will kill her.
The demon tore through the branches. It had a human shape now, not merely humanoid, and it had added the vines and branches to its appearance.
She did this to me.
No. Ululenia pulled at water and earth, shaped them to her will, and sent the ceiling crashing down upon the demon. You have no one to blame but yourself. Whatever regret you hold, whatever blame you might place, this is the seed you have planted, and only you may decide how it grows. She shook her head as she spoke to the pile of rubble that crumbled and cracked before her. I have pranced in woods the humans think enchanted, where demons who found freedom joined the earth until they became it. Turn from this hatred, and you could be the same. That is the good news. The rubble exploded, and the demon stood in what was left. It had a woman's form now, and its body was stone. No more tricks, it said as it leaped at Ululenia. The air around Ululenia shimmered, and what met the demon's charge was snowy white, and it had a rainbow horn upon its brow. But it had a lot more claws and fangs than anything that called itself a unicorn should ever have. No more tricks, Ululenia snarled through the saber teeth that jutted from her face, and she slashed with claws that tore through stone and ripped chunks from the demon's hide. For the bad news is that I know exactly how you feel. 10 minutes, several unconscious guards, and one small office fire later, Tern and Isadora came back to the entry room with a data crystal in hand. Hold on, said the Urujar guard as Tern approached, frowning. We're getting reports of possible trouble near the Lapis Avantum. Would you know anything about that? Well, said Tern, opening her mouth. That's a really good question, and the thing is, when you think about it... That has absolutely nothing to do with us, Desidora said from behind Tern. We don't know anything about it. We weren't even on that floor. Tern looked at Desidora, specifically in the over-her-head-where-flaring-purple-light-should-be area. Nothing. The guard did the same thing, frowning again. So where are you headed now? We're off to do a good day's work, going over the data for our report, Desidora said. Purple light flared over her head, and she sighed. Oh, for Tashaveth's sake. We're off to get Kava and see if we can meet anybody cute. The guard nodded slowly. All right. Have a good day. Tern and Isadora left the white marbled building and walked off into the safety of Rosler Nassef. So, Tern said when they were out of earshot, you can pretty much do your Death Priestess aura manipulation thing on the Verifier ward, and all the awesome, not-quite-lies I told were totally unnecessary. Maybe a little, Desidora said, smiling as they stopped at a corner. But why waste energy, if you can handle it? She raised her hand to hail a carriage. You could have told me, Tern muttered. A carriage came to a halt, and Tern grumped her way inside while Desidora spoke with the driver. Desidora slid into the carriage beside her. If I'd told you, you'd have stammered out the first one and then looked to me from then on out, she said as she sat down. The carriage slid into motion with a sound of hooves clopping on stone. Why the hell did I even come in the first place? Looking out the carriage window, Tern glared at the buildings. I hate Rosler Nassef. I could have bypassed the Verifier wards, Desidora said, smiling serenely. And perhaps I could even have altered the aura on your old badge from Heavenspire to make it function here. Oh, now I feel better. The sound of the horse's hooves changed as the carriage turned onto the coin bridge that separated the wealthy mansions of East Bank from the warehouses, guild houses, and carver houses of West Bank. But I could not have found the information you did in the Lapis Avantum, Desidora finished. You located data that by all rights should not have even existed. Data the ancients went to trouble to remove from all records. You also picked the lock that got us into the Lapis Avantum, and you located the room itself faster than I would have been able to. Hooray, Tern muttered. The small hexagonal stones that had given the coin bridge its name rattled beneath their seats. She remembered too many nights of coming back home across that bridge, feeling herself getting smaller and dumber, as a clever girl who hung out with dwarves and alchemists became the disappointing daughter who talked too much at the dances. At that, another thought struck her. Why are we crossing the coin bridge? She asked. The tree ship is waiting outside West Bank. The carriage left the bridge as it came onto Poya Avenue, then made the left turn onto Slow Ridge, the tight turn that forced the horse on the left to either stop or walk in place for a moment. You could tell which nobles had the most money, because they took the time to train their horses to walk in place, rather than just stopping, while the other horse made the turn, which was showy and pointless, and the kind of thing rich guild families took pride in. Tern knew that, the same way that she knew that the coin bridge led to Poya, and then Slowridge, and then Watchcombe, and then... "We are crossing the coin bridge," Desidora said, "because I am a love priestess, and not all love is romantic." "Desidora," Tern said. "These, no." "You agreed that we should warn them," Desidora pointed out.
"By letter," Tern said.
The carriage swung right onto Watchcombe.
"You don't know what this is like, Diz. You don't know what they are like."
"If something happened," Desidora said, "and you did not try, you would regret it."
"Would I?"
Tern asked with some venom, and the carriage rolled to a stop. Tern got out of the carriage, glaring at Desidora's winsome smile, and looked at the stately manor that rose tastefully behind a low iron fence that was more ornamental than practical. She had hopped that fence to sneak in dozens of times growing up, and hopped it to sneak out dozens of times plus one. Her steel-toed work boots clopped on the stones of the road. The lapitect robes slid clumsily as she pulled them over her head, revealing the many-pocketed brown work dress she wore underneath. She tugged at her hair as she walked toward the front gate, like that was going to do something.
"Your business, miss," said one of the guards at the gate.
He was polite and young. Tern had never met him.
"I'd like to see Master or Mistress Silkworth."
It came out scratchy at the end, and Tern wished she'd cleared her throat first.
"Ah," the guard smiled. "And who shall I say is calling?"
"Tell them," she swallowed. "Tell them Laridae is here."
The guard nodded, smiled again, and strolled off toward the back entrance of the manor. Tern stood and waited. After a minute, she realized that she was fidgeting with a cufflink that fired sleep darts and stopped herself with an effort. The other guard watched her impassively. He was older, and she thought that maybe she remembered him. The first guard finally came back, smiling apologetically.
"I'm terribly sorry, miss," he said through the bars, "but the Silkworths do not know anyone by that name."
Tern looked at the manor. The second window from the left on the upper floor had been Mother's reading room. The pale grey curtain twitched as it closed.
"I see."
Tern forced a smile and a nod to the guard, who was just the poor guy who had to deliver the message. The other guard, the older one, was trying not to smirk, and Tern realized that she did remember him after all.
"They did ask me to give you this," the nice guard added, and passed a pouch through the bars. "For any trouble you might encounter in the future."
Tern took the pouch of coins and smiled and started to walk away, her back straight and her head high. Then she stopped and turned.
"Hey!"
she called back to the gate. The young guard looked surprised and a bit shocked that she'd raised her voice.
"The Plumfisher acquisition. You tell them it's the Plumfisher acquisition all over again, and they should ride tight and count twice."
The young guard looked offended and confused simultaneously. The old guard frowned and put a hand on his blade. Tern stepped into the carriage and put the coin purse on the seat beside her.
"It was a time when the guild politics turned ugly," she said to Desidora, "and the nobles tried to play us against each other."
"Tern."
"They'll know what it means. They'll check security and increase the guard and..."
"Tern." Desidora reached out gently and pulled Tern into a hug.
"I'm sorry."
And that was when something in Tern's chest broke, and her breath caught and her eyes burned.
"Just get me the hell out of Rosslyn, Seth," Tern said, wiping her eyes. "And buy me a damn good drink later."
Locke and Icy were climbing over the Westdyke Estate's wall when a snowy white dove flapped past them, settled on a tree branch outside, and shifted into human form. Ululenia's dress was still white, but it was cut lower and clung to her more tightly. She rested on the branch with one leg stretched and the other bent, sliding out from a high slit in the hem. Her ash-blonde hair was no longer simple and straight, but tumbled over one shoulder, covering one eye before falling into lazy, sinuous curls. "Trouble?" Locke asked, hopping down from the wall and rolling as she landed.
"Nothing I couldn't handle, little one,"
Ululenia smiled. Her lips were darker than Locke remembered,
a rich red that made her bright white teeth seem sharper.
Glad to hear it.
Locke looked over as Icy landed beside her. He held up the book as confirmation, and Locke nodded.
Let's go, before Jell catches up.
It may take her some time to pull herself together, Ulilenia said, still smiling, and slid down from the tree.
We want in, said the glimmering man,
or the incomprehensible titanic creature working the glimmering man like a puppet.
It's more interesting where you are. Things taste better. We've eaten most of the good-tasting things here.
Hessler coughed.
I'm afraid that the path to my world is blocked, he said,
trying to push aside the way that the thing's words reverberated in his head, as if for a moment he had thought them himself.
It is very difficult, agreed the glimmering man.
The great mass of shimmering rainbows over pink. Skin, Hessler decided, coiled, then stretched. Not like a living creature with muscle and tendons, but like oil sliding across a hot pan. And all at once it was around Hessler as he turned to try to follow the movement. Instead of the strange alien starscape, there were rainbows all around him, shining and shimmering in a great sphere, perhaps 20 or 30 yards across, with just him and the glimmering man inside.
The things that make up your world are too heavy. When we touched the core of it, we could not stay ourselves, and we collapsed into nothing.
Yes, as I recall, the glimmering folk could not come to the ground, Hessler said,
his voice going up in pitch ever so slightly despite himself.
I assume that was one of the reasons you created creatures to fight for you on the ground against the ancients.
Yes, the things we made called this place the Shadowlands, and the ancients, the others.
Are they still there? The glimmering man asked, as the coils around Hessler tightened into a featureless sphere, offering no escape.
They tasted different. They came from below, and we came from above.
The words twisted around in Hessler's head, steadily tightening in his skull.
They made the door for us, and they were very angry when we came through.
As Hessler's eyes began to pound in time with his own pulse, the glimmering man said,
If I made a door, I would be happy with whatever came through. Demons or ancients or you.
Hessler's vision was going dark at the edges.
This is going to make for a fascinating paper, he said,
and flung out a hand.
But I cannot write it if my brain explodes.
He conjured an illusion of flame, a ball of fire between him and the glimmering man. At least that had been the intent. What actually happened was that the glimmering man's skin melted and then went scorched black as the glimmering man opened a toothless mouth in a wordless scream. The great massive coils that had formed the sphere around him darted back far faster than something so large should have been able to move, and in a flash it was over him, or across from him, still vast but not all around anymore. It roared, shaking the tiny little cord from which the glimmering man hung, like a man shaking a finger that had been burned on a stove, and its great expanse of skin, or scales, or slime, shifted from pink to grey. And from the great mass of tentacles, Hessler had still not placed any anatomy that he would properly call a face, and he wasn't even entirely sure about a torso, arose long barbed blades.
If illusions are reality, Hessler said, wiping cold sweat from his brow.
Then you should strongly consider leaving me in peace.
He flung his hands out again and collapsed upon the street in the middle of Ross Onaki. The crowd looked at him in confusion as he got back to his feet, and he heard people murmuring to themselves as he patted himself down and checked to ensure that he was all back. He saw wagons with tarps hung out to sell fruit, crates holding bolts of cloth and weapons, and people everywhere, talking and laughing and arguing as they bartered and walked. There was no question of it being a trick. The great form had barely been able to imitate a human form. A marketplace was out of the question, much less one with dynamic lighting textures, which, as an illusionist, Hessler understood to be hideously difficult. A chittering hiss sounded off to his right, out of place in the market, and Hessler turned to see the scorpion he had fought while rescuing Kale's mother. It stared at him,
the bulbous pouches on its carapace glowing and pulsing.
"Not murderer,"
it said, and then shadows closed around it, and it was gone. Hassler shook his head, and, for want of any other idea, headed off toward the tree ship.